consulting elsewhere. Yes, correct. A batholith.
A batholith, Fal said, eyebrows raised.
Just one. Just one.
This is a slightly low G-world? Thick crust?
Both.
Mm-hmm. So the mines inside these...
She looked along the terrace, not really seeing anything, but in her mind's eye, looking down kilometres of dark tunnels, and thinking there might be some pretty impressive mountains above them, all that granite, low G, good climbing territory. She looked at the machine again.
So what happened? It's a planet of the dead. Did the natives eventually do it to themselves?
With biological weapons, not nukes, to the last humanoid, 11,000 years ago.
Fal nodded.
Now it was obvious why the Dryasen had made Shah's world one of their planets of the dead. If you were a pure energy superspecies, long retired from the normal matter-based life of the galaxy, and your conceit was to cordon off and preserve the odd planet or two you thought might serve as a fitting monument to death and futility, Shah's world, with its short and sordid history, sounded like the sort of place you'd put pretty near the top of your list. Something occurred to her.
How come the tunnels haven't sealed up again over all that time? 5 clicks worth of pressure.
We don't know, Jace sighed. The Dryasen have not been very forthcoming with information. It is possible the system's engineers devised a technique for withstanding the pressure over such a period. This is unlikely, admittedly, but then they were ingenious.
Pity they didn't devote a little more ingenuity to staying alive, rather than conducting mass slaughter as efficiently as possible, Fal said, and made a little snorting noise.
Jace felt pleasure at the girl's words, if not the snort, but at the same time detected in them a tinge of that mixture of contempt and patronising smugness the culture found it so difficult not to exhibit when surveying the mistakes of less advanced societies, even though the source civilizations of its own mongrel past had been no less fallible. Still, the underlying point held. Experience as well as common sense indicated that the most reliable method of avoiding self-extinction was not to equip oneself with the means to accomplish it in the first place.
So, Fal said, looking down as she tapped her one good heel on the grey stones. The mines in the tunnels, the Dryasens on the outside. What's the quiet barrier limit?
The usual half-distance to the nearest other star. 310 standard light days in the case of Shah's world at the moment.
And?
She held out her hand to Jace and raised her head and eyebrows. Flower shadows moved on her neck as the gentlest of breezes started and ruffled the blossoms on the trelliswork above her head.
What's the problem?
Well, Jace said, the reason the mind was allowed in at all was because...
In distress, right, go on.
Jace, who had stopped being annoyed by Fal's interruptions the first time she brought it a mountain flower, went on. There is a small base on Shah's world, as there is on almost all the planets of the dead. As usual, it is staffed from a small, nominally neutral, non-dynamic society of some galactic maturity.
The Changer,
Fal broke in, quite slowly, as though guessing the answer to a puzzle which had been troubling her for hours and ought to have been simple. She looked through the flower-strewn trellis to a blue sky where a few small white clouds were moving slowly. She looked back to the machine.
I'm right, aren't I? That Changer guy who... And that special circumstance, Balveda? And the place where you have to be senile to rule. There are changes on Shah's world, and this bloke...
She broke off and frowned.
But I thought he was dead.
Now we're not so sure. The last message from the GCU nervous energy seemed to indicate he might have escaped.
What happened to the GCU?
We don't know. Contact was lost while it was trying to capture rather than destroy the Adiran ship. Both are presumed lost.
Capture it, eh? Fal said tartly. Another show-off mind. But that's it, isn't it? The Adirans might be able to use this guy. What's his name? Do we know?
Bora Horza Gobachul.
Whereas we don't have any changes.
We do. But the one we have is on the other side of the galaxy on an urgent job not connected with the war. It would take half a year to get her there. Besides, she has never been to Shah's world. The tricky part about this problem is that Bora Horza Gobachul has.
Ho-ho, Fal said.
In addition, we have unconfirmed information that the same Adiran fleet which knocked out the fleeing ship also tried unsuccessfully to follow the mine to Shah's world with a small landing force. Thus, the Dra'ezin concerned is going to be suspicious. It might let Borahorza Gobachul through, as he has served before with the caretaker staff on the planet, but even he is not certain to gain entry. Anybody else is very doubtful indeed.
Of course, the poor devil might be dead.
Changes are not notoriously easy to kill, and besides, it would seem unwise simply to count on that possibility.
And you're worried he might get to this precious mind and bring it back to the adherents?
It could just happen.
Just supposing it did happen, Jace, Fal said, screwing up her eyes and leaning forward to look at the machine. So what? Would it really make any difference? What would happen if the adherents did get their hands on this admittedly resourceful kid mind?
Assuming that we are going to win the war, Jace said thoughtfully, it could lengthen the proceedings by a handful of months.
And how many is that supposed to be? Fal said.
Somewhere between 3 and 7, I suppose. It depends whose hand you're using.
Fal smiled. And the problem is that the mind can't distract without making this planet of the dead even more dead than it is already. In fact, without making it an asteroid belt.
Exactly.
So maybe the little devil shouldn't have bothered saving itself from the wreck in the first place, and should have just gone down with the ship.
It's called the instinct to survive.
Jace paused while Fal nodded, then it went on.
It's programmed into most living things.
It made a show of weighing the girl's injured leg in its field-held grip.
Though, of course, there are always exceptions.
Yes, Fal said, giving what she hoped was a condescending smile. Very droll, Jace.
So, you see the problem?
I see the problem, Fal agreed. Of course, we could force our way in there and blow the place to smithereens if necessary, and to hell with the Dra'ezin. She grinned.
Yes, Jace conceded, and put the whole outcome of the war in jeopardy by antagonizing a power whose haziest unknown quantity is the exact extent of its immensity. We could also surrender to the adherents, but I doubt we'll do that either.
Well, so long as we're considering all the options. Fal laughed.
Oh, yes.
Okay, Jace, if that's all, let me think about this lot for a while, Fal and Ystra said, sitting up straight on the bench and stretching and yawning. It sounds interesting. She shook her head. This is Lap of the God stuff, though. Let me have anything you think might be relevant. I'd like to concentrate on this bit of the war for a while. All the information we've got on the Sullen Gulf. All I can handle, anyway. Okay?
Okay, Jace said.
Fal murmured, nodding vaguely, her eyes unfocused. Yes. All we've got on that general area. I mean, volume. She waved her hand round in a circle, in her imagination, encompassing several million cubic light-years.
Very well, Jace said,
and retreated slowly from the girl's gaze. It floated back down the terrace in the shafts of sunlight and shade towards the lodge under the flowers. The girl sat by herself, rocking backward and forward on her haunches and humming quietly, her hands at her mouth again and her elbows on her knees, one of which was bent and one of which was straight. Here we are, she thought, killing the immortal, only just stopping short of tangling with something most people would think of as a god. And here am I. 80,000 light-years away, I'm a meter, supposed to think of a way out of this ridiculous situation. What a joke. Damn. I wish they'd let me be a field referrer, out there where the action is, instead of sitting it out back here, so far away it takes 2 years just to get there. Oh, well. She shifted her weight and sat sideways on the seat, so that her broken leg lay along the bench, then turned her face to the mountains glittering on the far side of the plain. She rested her elbow on the stone parapet, her hand supporting her head as her eyes drank in the view. She wondered whether they really had kept their word about not watching her when she went climbing. She wouldn't put past them to have kept a small drone or micro-missile or something nearby, just in case anything did happen. And then, after the accident, after she'd fallen, left her lying there, frightened, cold and in pain, just to convince her they were doing no such thing, and to see the effect it had on her, as long as she wasn't in any real danger of dying. She knew, after all, the way their minds worked.
It was the sort of thing she would consider doing if she was in charge.
Maybe I should just pack it in. Leave. Tell them to shove their war. Trouble is, I like all this.
She looked at one of her hands, golden brown in a beam of sunlight. She opened and closed it, looking at the fingers.
3 to 7.
She thought of an Adiran hand.
Depending.
She looked back over the shadow-strewn plain toward the distant mountains and sighed. Chapter 5. Megaship. Vavach lay in space like a god's bracelet. The 14 million kilometer hoop glittered and sparkled, blue and gold against the jet-black gulf of space beyond. As the clear air turbulence warped in toward the orbital, most of the company watched their goal approach on the main screen in the mess. The aquamarine sea, which covered most of the surface of the artifact's ultra-dense base material, was spattered with white puffs of cloud, collected in huge storm systems or vast banks, some of which seemed to stretch right across the full 35,000-kilometre breadth of the slowly turning orbital. Only on one side of that looped band of water was there any land visible, hard up against one sloped retaining wall of pure crystal. Although from the distance they were watching, the sliver of land looked like a tiny brown thread lying on the edge of a great rolled-out bolt of vivid blue, that thread was anything up to 2,000 kilometres across. There was no shortage of land on Vavach. Its greatest attraction, however, was, and had always been, the megaships.
"Don't you have a religion?"
Dorolo asked Horza.
"Yes," he replied, not taking his eyes away from the screen on the wall above the end of the main messroom table. "My survival."
"So, your religion dies with you. How sad,"
Dorolo said, looking back from Horza to the screen. The changer let the remark pass. The exchange had started when Dorolo, struck by the beauty of the great orbital, expressed the belief that even though it was a work of base creatures no better than humans, it was still a triumphant testimony to the power of God, as God had made man and all other souled creatures. Horza had disagreed, genuinely annoyed that the woman could use even something so obviously a testament to the power of intelligence and hard work as an argument for her own system of irrational belief. Yalsin, who was sitting beside Horza at the table, and whose foot was gently rubbing the changer's ankle, put her elbows on the plastic surface beside the plates and beakers. "And they're going to blow it away in 4 days' time. What a fucking waste." Whether or not this would have worked as a subject-changing parry, she did not get a chance to find out, because the mess PA crackled once, and then came clear with the voice of Craiglin, who was on the bridge.
"Thought you might like to see this, people."
The view of the distant orbital was replaced by a blank screen, onto which there then appeared a message in flashing letters.
"Warning. Signal. Warning. Signal. Warning. Signal. Warning.
Attention all craft. Vavach orbital and hub with all ancillary units will be destroyed, repeat, destroyed, Moraine time A4872.0001, exact. Equivalent G-hub time 0043.2909.401. Equivalent LIM 3 time 09.256.8. Equivalent IDEA time relative Kur Uribalta 359.0021. Equivalent Vavach time SEG 7th 4010.5. By Nova level hyper grid intrusion and subsequent CAM bombardment. Sent by eschatologist. Temporary name, Culture General Systems Vehicle, timed at A4870.986. Moraine Base Alltrans. Signal section end. Signal repetition number 1 of 7 follows. Warning. Signal. Warning. Signal. Warning.
"We just ran through that message shell," Craiglin added. "See you later."
The PA crackled again, then was silent. The message faded from the screen, and the orbital filled it again.
"Hmm," Jandra Legelli said, brief and to the point. "Like I said,"
Yalsin nodded at the screen.
"I remember," Wubslin
said slowly, staring at the band of brilliant blue and white on the screen.
"When I was very young, one of my teachers floated a little toy metal boat on the surface of a bucket full of water. Then she lifted the bucket by the handle
and held me up against her chest with her other arm, so that I was facing the same way she was. She started to go round and round, faster and faster, letting the spin send the bucket out away from her, and eventually the bucket was straight out, the surface of the water in it at 90 degrees to the floor. And I was held there with this great big adult hand across my belly, and everything spinning around me, and I was watching this little toy boat, which was still floating on the water, even though the water was straight up and down in front of my face. And my teacher said, "You remember this if you're ever lucky enough to see the megaships of Vavach?"
"Yeah," Lam said. "Well, they're about to let the fucking handle go."
"So let's just hope we're not still on the surface when they do," Yalson said. Jandra Ligeli turned to her, one eyebrow up.
"After that last fiasco, dear, nothing would surprise me."
"Easy in, easy out," Avager said, and the old man laughed.
The haul from Marjoin to Vavach had taken 23 days. The company had gradually recovered from the effects of the abortive attack on the Temple of Light. There were a few small sprains and grazes. Dorilo had been blind in one eye for a couple of days, and everybody had been quiet and withdrawn. But by the time Vavach came into sight, they were all starting to get so bored with life on board ship, even with less of them on it, that they were looking forward to another operation. Hawser kept the laser rifle which Ki Alsorifus had used and carried out what rudimentary repairs and improvement the cat's limited engineering facilities would allow him to effect to his suit. Craiglin was full of praise for the one he had taken from Hawser. It had lifted him out of the worst of the trouble in the hall of the Temple of Light, and although it had still taken some heavy fire pulses, it was hardly marked, let alone damaged. Nysin had said he'd never liked lasers anyway, and wouldn't use one again. He had a perfectly good rapid-firing light projectile rifle and lots of ammunition. He would carry that in future when he wasn't using the micro-howitzer. Hawser and Yalson had started sleeping together every night in what was now their cabin, the one the two women had occupied. During the long days of the voyage, they had grown closer but spoken comparatively little for new lovers. Both seemed to want it that way. Hawser's body had completed its regeneration after its impersonation of the Gerontocrat, and there was no longer any trace or sign of that role left on him. But while he told the company that he was now the way he had always looked, he had, in fact, moulded his body to look like that of Craiglin. Hawser was a little taller and fuller-chested than his neutral normal, and his hair was darker and thicker. His face, of course, he could not yet afford to change, but under its light brown surface it was ready. A short trance, and he could pass for the captain of the Clear Air Turbulence. Perhaps Vavach would give him the opportunity he needed. He had thought long and hard about what to do now that he was part of the company and relatively safe, but cut off from his Adiran employers. He could always just go on his own way, but that would let down Zoralundra, whether the old Adiran was alive or dead. It would also be running away from the war, from the culture, and the part he had chosen to play against it. In addition, at first, there was the idea Hawser had been toying with anyway, even before he had heard that his next task was to involve going to Shah's world, and that was the idea of returning to an old love. Her name was Sro Kirchel Zorant. She was what they called a dormant changer, one who had no training in and no desire to practice changing, and had accepted the post on Shah's world partly as a relief from the increasingly warlike atmosphere in the changer's home asteroid of Habor. That had been 7 years before, when Habor was already within what was generally recognised as being Adiran space, and when many changers were already employed by the Adirans. Hawser was sent to Shah's world partly because he was being punished and partly for his own protection. A group of changers had plotted to fire up the ancient asteroid's power plants and take it out of Adiran space, make their home and their species neutral again in the war they could see was becoming inevitable. Hawser had discovered the plot and killed two of the conspirators. The court of the Academy of Military Arts on Habor, its ruling body in all but name, had compromised between popular feeling on the asteroid, which wanted Hawser punished for taking other changers' lives, and the gratitude it felt toward Hawser. The court had a delicate task, considering the not wholehearted support the majority of changers gave to staying where they were, and therefore within the Adiran sphere of influence. By sending Hawser to Shah's world with instructions to stay there for several years, but not punishing him otherwise, the court hoped to make all concerned feel their own particular view had carried the day. To the extent that there was no revolt, that the Academy remained the ruling force in the asteroid, and that the services of changes were in demand as never before since the formation of their unique species, the court had succeeded. In some ways, Hawser had been lucky. He was without friends or influence. His parents were dead. His clan was all but defunct, save for him. Family ties meant a lot in the Changer society, and with no influential relatives or friends to speak for him, Hawser had perhaps escaped more lightly than he had a right to expect. Hawser cooled his heels on Shah's world's snows for less than a year before leaving to join the Adirans in their fight against the culture, both before and after it was officially termed a war. During that time, he had started a relationship with one of the four other Changers there, the woman Changer, Kirahel, who disagreed with almost everything Hawser believed, but had loved him, body and mind, despite it all. When he left, he knew it had hurt her much more than it had hurt him. He had been glad of the companionship, and he liked her, but he hadn't felt anything like what humans were supposed to feel when they talked of love, and by the time he left, he was starting, just starting, to grow bored. He told himself at the time that that was the way life was, that he would only hurt her more in the end by staying, and that it was partly for her sake he was leaving. But the expression in her eyes the last time he'd looked into them had not been something he enjoyed thinking about for a long time. He had heard she was still there, and he thought of her and had fond memories. And the more he had risked his life, and the more time had elapsed, the more he wanted to see her again, the more a quieter, less dangerous sort of existence appealed to him. He had imagined the scene, imagined the look in her eyes when he came back to her. Maybe she would have forgotten about him, or even be committed to some relationship with the other Changers at the base on Shah's world. But Hawser didn't really think so. He thought of such things only as a sort of insurance. Yalson made things a little difficult, perhaps, but he was trying not to build too much into their friendship and coupling, even though he was fairly sure it was only those two things to her as well. So, he would impersonate Craiglin if he could, or at least kill him and just take over, and hope he could get round the comparatively crude identity fidelities built into the cat's computer, or get somebody else to do so. Then he would take the clear air turbulence to Shah's world, rendezvous with the Adirans if he could, but go in anyway, assuming Mr. Adequate, the pet name the Changers on the Shah's world base had for the Dryazan being which guarded the planet, would allow him through the quiet barrier after the Adirans' botched attempt to fool it with a hollowed-out Choihirtzi. He would, if at all possible, give the rest of the company the chance to back out. One problem was knowing when to strike at Craiglin. Hawser was hoping that an opportunity would arise on Vavach, but it was hard to make definite plans because Craiglin didn't seem to have any of his own. He had simply talked of opportunities on the orbital, which were bound to arise due to its impending destruction, whenever he had been asked during the journey. "That lying bastard," Yalson said one night when they were about halfway to Vavach from Marduin. They were lying together in what was now their cabin, in the darkness of the ship night, in about a half G on the cramped bed space. "What?" Hawser said. "Don't you think he's going to Vavach after all?" "Oh, he's going there, all right, but not because there are unknown possibilities for a successful job. He's going for the damage game." "What damage game?" Hawser asked, turning to her in the darkness where her naked shoulders lay on his arm. He could feel their soft down against his skin. "You mean a big game? A real one?" "Yeah, the ring itself. Last I heard, it was only a rumor, but it makes more sense every time I think about it. Vavach is a certainty, provided they can get a quorum together." "The player's on the eve of destruction," Hawser laughed gently. "You think Craiglin means to watch or play?" "He'll try to play, I suppose. If he's as good as he says he is, they might even let him, as long as he can raise the stake. That's supposed to be how he won the cat. Not off anybody in a ring game, but it must have been pretty heavy company if they were gambling ships. But I guess he'd be prepared to watch it if he came to it. I bet that's why we're all going on this little holiday. He might try and come up with some sort of excuse or fabricate some op, but that's the real reason. Damage. Either he's heard something or he's making an intelligent guess, but it's so fucking obvious." Her voice died away, and Hawser felt her shake her head on his arm. "Isn't one of the ring regulars," he said, "Galsel?" Now Hawser could feel the light, short-haired head nod against the skin of his arm.
Yeah, he'll be there, if he possibly can be.
He'd burn out the motors on the leading edge to get to a major damage game, and the way things have been hotting up in this neck of the woods recently, presenting all those wonderful easy-in, easy-out opportunities, I can't imagine him being far away. Yalson's voice sounded bitter. Myself? I think Galsell's the subject of Craiglin's wet dreams. Thinks the guy's a fucking hero. Shit.
Yalson, Hawser said into the woman's ear, her hair tickling his nose.
One, how does Craiglin have wet dreams if he doesn't sleep? And two, what if he has these cabins bugged? Her head turned towards him quickly.
So fucking what? I'm not afraid of him. He knows I'm one of the most reliable people he's got. I shoot straight and I don't fill my pants when it starts getting hot.
I also think Craiglin's the best excuse for a leader we've got on the ship or are likely to get, and he knows that.
Don't you worry about me.
Anyway. He felt her shoulders and head move again and knew she was looking at him.
You'd settle it up if I got shot in the back, wouldn't you?
The thought had never occurred to him.
Wouldn't you? She repeated.
Well, of course I would, he said. She didn't move. He could hear her breathing.
You would, wouldn't you? Yalson said.
He brought his arms up and took her by the shoulders. She was warm. The down on her skin was soft, and the muscles and flesh underneath over her slim frame were strong and firm.
Yes, I would, he said, and only then realized that he meant it.
It was during this time, between Marjorin and Vavach, that the Changer found out what he wanted to know about the controls and fidelities of clear air turbulence. Craiglin wore an identity ring on the small finger of his right hand, and some of the locks in the cat would work only in the presence of that ring's electronic signature. The control of the ship depended on an audio-visual identity link. Craiglin's face was recognized by the craft's computer, as was his voice when he said,
"This is Craiglin."
It was that simple. The ship had once had a retina recognition lock as well, but it had malfunctioned long before and been removed. Hawser was pleased. Copying somebody's retina pattern was a delicate and tricky operation, requiring, among a lot of other things, the careful growth of lasing cells around the iris. It almost made more sense to go for a total genetic transcription, where the subject's own DNA became the model for a virus which left only the changer's brain, and, optionally, gonads, unaltered. That wouldn't be necessary to impersonate Captain Craiglin, however. Hawser found out about the ship's fidelities when he asked the man for a lesson on how to fly the vessel. Craiglin had been reluctant at first, but Hawser had not pressed him and had answered a few of Craiglin's apparently casual questions about computers which followed this request with feigned ignorance. Seemingly convinced that teaching Hawser how to fly the cat would not carry the risk of him taking over the ship, Craiglin relented and allowed Hawser to practice piloting the craft on manual using the rather crude controls in simulator mode under MIPS instruction while the craft went on its way through space toward Vavach on autopilot.
"This is Craiglin,"
the ship PA announced to the mess, a few hours after they ran through the culture transmission, warning of the orbital's destruction. They were sitting around after a meal, drinking or inhaling, relaxing or, in Doralo's case, making the circle of flame sign on her forehead and saying the prayer of thanks. The big orbital was still on the mess screen and had grown much larger, almost filling it with its inner surface daylight side. But everybody had grown a little blasé about it and now gave it only the occasional glance. All the remaining company were there, save for Lenny Pobra and Craiglin himself. They looked at each other, or the PA speaker, when Craiglin spoke.
"I've got a job for us. Something I just had confirmed. Wabslin, you get the shuttle ready. I'll meet the rest of you in the hangar in 3 ship hours. Suit it up, team. And don't worry, this time there'll be no hostiles. This time it really is, you know what. In and out."
The speaker crackled, then went silent. Hawser and Yalson exchanged looks.
"So," Jandrelligelli said, leaning back in his chair and putting his hands behind his neck.
The scar marks on his face deepened slightly as he put on an expression of thoughtfulness.
"Our esteemed leader has again found us something to employ our slight talents."
"Better not be another fucking temple," Lamb growled,
scratching the small horn grafts where they joined his head.
"How are you going to find a temple on Vavach?"
Nysin said. He was slightly drunk, talking more than he normally did when with the others. Lam turned his face toward the smaller man, a few seats away and on the other side of the table.
"You'd better just sober up, friend," he said.
"Sea ships,"
Nyssen told him, taking the nippled cylinder from the table in front of him.
"Nothing but goddamn sea ships on that place. No temples."
He closed his eyes, put his head back, and drank.
"There might," Jandra Legelli said, "be temples on the ships."
"There might be a fucking drunk on this spy ship," Lam said, watching Nyssen.
Nyssen looked at him.
"You'd better sober up fast, Nyssen," Lam continued, pointing with one finger at the smaller man.
"Think I'll head for the hangar," Wobslin said, standing and walking out of the mess.
"I'm going to see if Craiglin wants a hand," Mip said, leaving in the opposite direction through another door.
"Think we could see any of those megaships yet?"
Avager was looking back at the screen. Dorilo looked up at it too.
"That'd be fucking stupid," Lam told him. "They aren't that big."
"They're big,"
Nyssen said, nodding to himself and the small cylinder. Lam looked at him, then at the others and shook his head.
"Yeah,"
Nyssen said.
"They're pretty big."
"They're actually no more than a few kilometres long," sighed Jandra Legelli, sitting back in his chair and looking thoughtful, emphasising the scar marks still further. "So you won't see them from this far out, but they certainly are large."
"And they just go round and round the whole orbital?" Yelsen said. She already knew, but she would rather have the Mondladishian talking than Lam and Nyssen arguing. Horza smiled to himself. Jandra Legelli nodded.
"Forever and ever. It takes them about 40 years to go right round in a circle."
"Don't they ever stop?" Yelsin asked. Jandra Legelli looked at her and raised an eyebrow.
"It takes them several years just to get to full speed, young lady. They weigh about 1 billion tons. They never stop. They just keep going round in circles. Full-size liners go on excursions and act as tenders. And they use aircraft, too."
"Did you know?" Avager said, looking round those still seated at the table and leaning forward with his elbows tightly folded.
"You actually weigh less on a megaship. It's because they go round in the opposite direction from the way the orbital spins."
Avager paused and frowned.
"Or is it the other way round?"
"Ah, fuck," Lam said, shaking his head violently, then getting up and leaving.
Jandra Legelli frowned.
"Fascinating," he said.
Dorilo smiled at Avager, and the old man looked round the others, nodding.
"Well, whatever. It's a fact," Avager declared.
"Right."
Craiglin placed one foot up on the shuttle's rear ramp and put his hands on his hips. He wore a pair of shorts. His suit stood ready to be put on, open down the chest front like a discarded insect skin just behind him.
"I told you we've got a job. This is what it is."
Craiglin paused, looked at the company standing or sitting or leaning on guns and rifles throughout the hangar.
"We're going to hit one of the megaships."
He paused, apparently waiting for a reaction. Only Avager looked surprised and in any way excited. The rest, with only Mip and the recently woken Lenipobra absent, seemed unimpressed. Mip was on the bridge. Lenipobra was still struggling to get ready in his cabin.
"Well," Craiglin said, annoyed. "You all know that Vavetch is going to get blown away by the culture in a few days. People have been getting everything they can off the place, and the megaships are all abandoned now, apart from a few wrecking and salvage teams. I guess all the valuables are off them. But there is one ship called the Ormadreka, where a couple of the teams had a little argument. Some careless person let off a little nuke, and now the Ormadreka's got a damn great hole in one side. It's still afloat, and it's still scrubbing off speed, but because the nuke went off on one side and that hole hasn't done a lot for the ship's streamlining, it started going round in a big curve, and it's getting closer to the outside edge wall all the time. The last transmission I picked up, nobody was sure whether it would hit before the culture starts blasting or not. But they don't seem happy to take the chance, so it looks like there isn't anybody on board."
"You want us to go onto it?"
Yelsen said. "Yeah, because I've been on the Ormadreka, and I think I know something people would have forgotten in the rush to get off. Bow lasers."
A few of the company looked sceptically from one to another.
"Yeah, megaships have bow lasers, especially the Ormadreka. That used to sail through stretches of the Circle Sea a lot of the other ships didn't go through. Places where there was a lot of floating weeds or icebergs, It couldn't exactly manoeuvre out of the way, so it had to be able to destroy anything in its path and have the firepower to do it. The Ulmerdrecker's front armament would put a few fleet battleships to shame. That thing could frazzle its way through an iceberg bigger than it was itself and blast islands of floatweed out of the water so big that people used to think it was attacking the Edgeland. My guess, and it's an educated one because I've been reading between the lines of the outcoming signals, is that nobody's remembered about all that weaponry, and so we're going to go for it.
What if this ship hits the wall while we're on board?
Dorolo said.
Craiglin smiled at her.
We're not blind, are we? We know where the wall is, and we know where. We'll be able to see where the Ulmerdrecker is. We'll go down, take a look, and then if we decide we have the time, we'll remove a few of the smaller lasers. Hell, just one would do. I'm going to be down there too, you know, and I'm not going to risk my own neck if I can see the edge wall looming up, am I?
We taking the kid?
Lamb said.
Not over the top. The orbital's got just enough mass to make the warp a tricky proposition, and the fusions will get zapped by the hub auto-defences. They think our motors were meteorites or something. No, we'll leave the cat here unmanned. I can always control it remotely from my suit if there's an emergency. We'll use the shuttle's FFD. Force fields work fine on an orbital.
Oh, that's one thing I shouldn't really have to remind you about. Don't try to use your AG on the place, okay?
Anti-gravity works against mass, not spin. So you'd end up taking an unexpected bath if you jumped over the side expecting to fly around to the bows.
What do we do after we get this laser? If we get it? Yelson said.
Craiglin frowned briefly. He shrugged.
Probably the best thing is to head for the capital. It's called Evenath, a port where they used to build the megaships. It's on the land, of course.
He smiled, looking at some of the others.
Yeah,
Yelson said. But what do we do once we get there?
Well,
Craiglin looked hard at the woman. Hawser kicked her heel with his toe.
Yelson glared round at the changer while Craiglin spoke.
We might be able to use the port facilities, in space that is, on the underside of Evenath, to mount the laser. But anyway, I'm sure the culture will be prompt, so we might even just go to sample the last days of one of the most interesting combined ports of call in the galaxy. And it's last night, so I might add.
Craiglin looked at several of the others, and there was some laughter and a few remarks. He stopped smiling and looked at Yelson again.
So, it could be quite interesting, don't you think?
Yeah, all right. You're the boss, Craiglin.
Yelson grinned, then put her head down. Under her breath to Hawser, she hissed,
Guess where the damage game is.
Wouldn't this big sea ship go right through the wall and wreck the orbital anyway, before the culture does anything?
Avager was saying.
Craiglin smiled condescendingly and shook his head.
I think you'll find the edge walls are up to it.
I hope so.
Avager laughed.
Well, don't worry about it, Craiglin reassured him. Now, somebody give Wapslin a hand to run a final check on the shuttle. I'm going up to the bridge to make sure Mip knows what to do. We'll be setting off in about 10 minutes.
Craiglin stepped back and into his suit, gathering it up and putting his arms into the sleeves. He fastened the main chest latches, picked up his helmet and nodded to the company as he walked by them and up the steps out of the hangar.
Were you trying to annoy him? Hawser asked Yelson.
She turned to the changer.
I just wanted to give him a hint that I could see through him. He doesn't fool me.
Wubslin and Avager were taking the shuttle. Lamb was fiddling with his laser. Jandralajeli stood with arms crossed, his back resting against the hangar bulkhead near the door, eyes raised to the ceiling lights, a bored expression on his face. Nysin was talking quietly to Dorolo, who saw the small man as a possible convert to the Circle of Flame.
You reckon Evenath is where this damage game's going to be? Hawser asked.
He was smiling. Yalson's face looked very small inside the big, still open neck of her suit and very serious.
Yes, I do. That devious bastard probably invented the whole goddamn op on this megaboat thing. He's never told me he'd been to Vavach before, lying bastard.
She looked at Hawser, punched him in the suit belly, making him laugh and dance back.
What are you smiling at?
You? Hawser laughed.
So what if he wants to go and play a game of damage? You keep saying it's his ship and he's the boss and all that crap, but you won't let the poor guy have a bit of fun.
So why doesn't he admit it?
Yelson nodded sharply at Hawser.
Because he doesn't want to share any of his winnings, that's why.
The rule is we divide everything we make, sharing it out according to...
Well, I can see his point if that's what it is, Hauser said reasonably. If he wins in a damage game, it's all his own work. Nothing to do with us.
That's not the point, Yarsen yelled. Her mouth was set in a tight line. Her hands were on her hips. She stamped her feet.
Okay, Hauser said, grinning.
So, when you bet on me to win my fight with Zalin, why didn't you give all your winnings right back again?
That's different, Yarsen said in exasperation.
But she was interrupted.
Hey!
Lenny Pobra came bounding down the steps into the hangar as Hauser was about to say something. Both he and Yarsen turned to the younger man as he skipped up to them, fastening his suit gloves to the cuffs.
Did you see that message earlier?
He looked excited and didn't seem to be able to keep still. He kept rubbing his gloved hands together and shuffling his feet.
Novigrid Gridfire! Wow! What a spectacle! I love the culture and a cam dustin! Hoo-wee!
He laughed, doubled at the waist, slapped both hands on the hangar deck, bounced up and smiled at everybody. Doralo scratched her ears and looked puzzled. Lam glared at the youth over the barrel of his rifle, while Yarsen and Hauser looked at each other, shaking their heads. Lenny Pobra went dancing and shadowboxing up to Jandra Legelli, who raised one eyebrow and watched the gangly young man prancing about in front of him.
The weaponry of the end of the universe, and this young idiot is practically coming in his pants.
Oh, you're just a spoilsport, Legelli,
Lenny Pobra said to the Mondladician, stopping dancing and dropping his punching arms to turn away and slouch off toward the shuttle. As he passed Yarsen and Hauser, he muttered,
Yarsen, what the hell is Cam anyway?
Collapsed antimatter, kid. Yarsen smiled as Lenny Pobra kept on walking. Hauser laughed soundlessly as the young man's head nodded inside the open neck of his suit. He walked into the open rear of the shuttle. The clear air turbulence rolled. The shuttle left the hangar and flew along the underside of the Vavach orbital, leaving the spacecraft flying underneath like a tiny silver fish under the hull of some great dark ship. On a small screen, fitted at one end of the shuttle's main compartment since its last outing, the suited figures could watch the seemingly endless curve of ultra-dense base material stretching off into the dark distance lit by starlight. It was like flying upside down over a planet made of metal, and of all the sights the galaxy held which were the result of conscious effort, it was one bested for what the culture would call GORP value, only by a big ring or a sphere. The shuttle crossed 1,000 kilometers of the smooth undersurface, then suddenly, above it, there was a wedge of darkness, a slant of something which looked even smoother than the base material, but which was clear, transparent, and angling out from the base itself and slicing into space like the edge of a crystal knife for 2,000 kilometers. The edge wall. This was the wall bordered by sea on the far side of the orbital from the thread of land they had seen on their approach in the cat. The first 10 kilometers of the flat curve were dark as space. Their mirror surface showed only when stars reflected on them. And looking at that perfect image, the mind could spin, seeing for what looked like light years, when in fact the surface was only a few thousand meters away.
God, that thing's big,
Nysin whispered. The shuttle continued to rise, and above it there appeared through the wall a glow of light, a shining expanse of blue. Into sunlight, hardly filtered through the transparent wall, the shuttle climbed in empty space beside the edge wall. 2 kilometers away there was air, even if it was thin air, but the shuttle climbed in nothing, angling out along with the wall as it sloped towards its line of summit. The shuttle crossed that knife edge, 2,000 kilometers up from the base of the orbital, then started to follow the slope of wall back down on the inside. It passed through the orbital's magnetic field, a region where small magnetized particles of artificial dust blocked out some of the sun's rays, so making the sea below it cooler than elsewhere on the world, producing Vavach's different climates. The shuttle continued to fall, through ions, then thin gases, finally into thin and cloudless air, shuddering in a Coriolis jet stream. The sky above turned from black to blue. The orbital of Vavach, a 14-million-kilometre hoop of water seemingly hung naked in space, spread out before the falling craft like some vast circular painting.
Well, at least we're in daylight, Yarsen said.
Let's just hope our captain's information about exactly where this wonderful ship is turns out to be accurate. The screen showed clouds. As the shuttle fell and flew, it was coming down onto a false landscape of water vapour. The clouds seemed to stretch forever along the curved inside surface of the orbital, which even from that height looked flat, then sweeping up into the black sky above. Only much further away could they see the blue expanse of real ocean, though there were hints of smaller patches closer to hand.
"Don't worry about the cloud," Craiglin said over the cabin speaker. "That'll shift as the morning wears on."
The shuttle was still dropping, still flying forward through the thickening atmosphere. After a while, they started going through the first few very high-altitude clouds. Hawser shifted slightly in his suit. Ever since the cat had matched velocities and curve with the big orbital and turned off its own AG, the craft and the company had been under the same fake gravity of the construction's spin. Slightly more, in fact, because they were stationary relative to the base, but further out from it. Vavach, whose original builders had come from a higher G planet, was spun to produce about 20% more gravity than the accepted human average which the cat's generator was set for. So Hawser, like the rest of the company, felt heavier than he was used to. His suit was chafing already. Clouds filled the cabin screen with grey.
"There it is," Craiglin shouted,
not trying to keep the excitement from his voice. He had been quiet for almost a quarter of an hour, and people had started to get restless. The shuttle had banked a few times this way and that, apparently searching for the Olmedrekka. Sometimes the screen had been clear, showing layers of cloud beneath. Sometimes it hazed over with grey again as they entered another bank or pillar of vapour. Once it had iced over.
"I can see the topmost towers."
The company crowded forward in the cabin, getting out of their seats and coming closer to the screen. Only Lam and General Ajeli stayed sitting down.
"About fucking time," Lam said. "How the hell do you have to look at all this time for something 4K long?"
"It's easy when you've no radar," General Ajeli said. "I'm just thankful we didn't hit the damn thing while we were flying through those awful clouds."
"Shit,"
Lam said, and inspected his rifle again.
"Look at that,"
Nysin said. In a wasteland of clouds, like some vast canyon torn in a planet made of vapour, through kilometres of levels, and in a space so long and wide that even in the clear air between the piled clouds the view simply faded rather than ended, the Olmedrekka moved. Its lower levels of superstructure were quite hidden, invisible in the ocean-hugging bank of mist. But from its unseen decks rose immense towers and structures of glass and light metal, rearing hundreds of metres into the clear air. Seemingly unconnected, they moved slowly and smoothly over the flat surface of the low bank of cloud like pieces on an endless game board, casting dim and watery shadows on the opaque top of the mist as the sun of Vavach's system shone through layers of cloud 10 kilometres above. As those huge towers moved through the air, they left behind them wisps and strands of vapour, ruffled from the mist's smooth top by the passage of the great ship beneath. In the small, clear spaces that the towers and higher levels of superstructure left in the mist, lower levels could be seen. Walkways and promenades, the linked arches of a monorail system, pools and small parks with trees, even a few pieces of equipment like small flyers and bits of tiny, doll's house-like furniture. As the eye and brain grasped the scene, they could, from that height, make out the overall bulge in the surface of the cloud that the ship made. An area of slight uplift in the mist, 4 kilometres long and nearly 3 wide, and shaped like a stubby pointed leaf or an arrowhead. The shuttle came lower. The towers with their glinting windows, their suspended bridges, flyer pads, aerials, railings, decks and flapping awnings sailed by alongside, silent and dark.
"Well," Craiglin's voice said in a businesslike way, "looks like we'll have a bit of a walk to the bows, team. I can't take us under this lot. Still, we're a good 100 kilometres away from the edge wall, so we've got plenty of time. The ship isn't heading straight for it anyway. I'll put this down as close as I can."
"Fuck, here we go,"
Lam said angrily. "I might have known."
"A long walk in this gravity is just what I need," Chandra Lajeli said.
"It's vast." Lenny Pobra was still staring at the screen. "That thing is huge."
He was shaking his head. Lam got up from his seat, pushed the youth out of the way and banged on the door of the shuttle flight deck.
"What is it?" Craiglin said over the cabin speaker. "I'm looking for a place to put down. If that's you, Lamb, just sit down."
Lamb stared at the door with a look first of surprise, then of annoyance. He snorted and went back to his seat, shoving past Lenny Pobber again.
"Bastard,"
he muttered, then put his helmet visor down and turned it to mirror.
"Right," Craiglin said. "We're putting down."
Those still standing sat again, and in a few seconds the shuttle bumped carefully down. The doors jawed, and a cold gust of air entered through them. They filed out slowly into the wide views of the silent, rock-steady megaship. Hawser sat in the shuttle, waiting for the rest to go, then saw Lamb watching him. Hawser stood and gave a mock bow to the dark-suited figure.
"After you?" he said.
"Nah," Lamb said. "You first."
He nodded his head to one side toward the open doors. Hawser went out of the shuttle, followed by Lamb. Lamb always made a point of being last out of the shuttle. It was lucky for him. They stood on a flyer landing pad near the base of a large rectangular tower of superstructure, perhaps 60 meters tall. The decks of the tower soared into the sky above, while over the surface of the cloud bank in front and to all sides of the pad, towers and small bulges in the mist showed where the rest of the ship was, though where it ended it was impossible to tell now that they were so low down. They couldn't even see where the nuke had gone off. There was no list, not a tremor to reveal that they were really on a damaged ship travelling over an ocean, not standing in a deserted city with clouds moving smoothly past. Hawser joined some of the others by a low restraining wall at the edge of the pad, looking down about 20 meters to a deck just visible now and again through the thin surface of the mist. Streamers of vapour flowed across the area below in long, sinuous waves, sometimes revealing, sometimes obscuring a deck covered with patches of earth, planted with small bushes, with little canopies and chairs scattered about, and small tent-like buildings on the surface. It all looked deserted and forlorn, like a resort in winter, and Hawser shivered inside his suit. Ahead of them, the view led to an implied point about a kilometre away, where a few small, skinny towers poked out of the cloud bank near the unseen bows of the craft.
"Looks like we're heading into even more cloud," Wubslin said, pointing in the direction they were heading.
There, a great canyon wall of cloud hung in the air, stretching from one side of the horizon to the other, and higher than any tower on the megaship. It shone for them in the increasing sunlight.
"Maybe it'll go away as it gets warmer," Dorolo said,
not sounding convinced.
"If we hit that lot, we can forget about these lasers," Hawser said, looking round from the rest toward the shuttle, where Craiglin was talking to Mip, who was to stay on guard at the shuttlecraft while the rest went forward to the bows.
"There's no radar, we'll have to lift off before we go into the cloud bank."
"Maybe,"
Yalson began.
"Well, I'm going to take a look down there," Lenny Pobre said,
bringing his visor down and putting one hand on the low parapet. Hawser looked across at him. Lenny Pobre waved.
"See you at the bows. Yahoo!"
He vaulted cleanly over the parapet and started to fall toward the deck 5 stories below. Hawser had opened his mouth to shout and started forward to grab the youth, but, like the rest of them, he had realized too late what Lenny Pobre was doing. One second he was there. The next, he'd leapt over.
"No! Lenny!"
Those not already looking down rushed to the parapet. The tiny figure was tumbling. Hawser saw it and hoped that somehow it could pull up, stop, do something. The scream started in their helmets when Lenny Pobre was less than 10 meters from the deck below. It ended abruptly, the instant the spread-eagled figure crashed onto the border of a small earthed area. It bounced slackly for about 1 meter over the deck, then lay still.
"Oh my God!"
Nysin suddenly sat down, took off his helmet and put his hand to his eyes. Dorolo put her head down and started to unfasten her helmet.
"What the hell was that?"
Craiglin was running over from the shuttle, Mip behind him. Hawser was still looking over the parapet, down at the still, doll-like figure crumpled on the deck below. Mist thickened around it as the wisps and streamers grew thicker for a while.
"Lenny Pobre? Lenny Pobre?"
Wubslin shouted into his helmet microphone. Yalson turned away and swore to herself softly, turning off her transmit intercom. Avager stood, shaking, his face blank inside his helmet visor. Craiglin skidded to a halt at the parapet, then looked over.
Lenny?
He looked round at the others.
Is that... What happened? What was he doing? If any of you were fooling...
He jumped,
Jandralajeli said. His voice was shaky. He tried to laugh.
Guess kids these days just can't tell their gravity from their rotating frame of reference.
He jumped, Craiglin shouted.
He grabbed Jandralajeli by the suit collar.
How could he jump? I told you AG wouldn't work. I told you all when we were in the hangar.
He was light, Lam broke in. He kicked at the thin metal of the parapet, feeling to dent it.
The stupid little bastard was light. None of us thought to tell him.
Craiglin let go of Jandralajeli and looked around the rest. It's true, Horza said. He shook his head.
I just didn't think. None of us did.
Lam and Jandralajeli were even complaining about having to walk to the bows when Lenny was in the shuttle, and you mentioned it, but I suppose he just didn't hear.
Horza shrugged.
He was excited.
He shook his head.
We all fucked up,
Yalson said heavily. She had turned her communicator back on. Nobody spoke for a while. Craiglin stood and looked around them, then went to the parapet, put both hands on it and looked down.
Lenny?
Wupslin said into his communicator, looking down too. His voice was quiet.
Chaisel or Hava?
Dorolo made the circle of flame sign, closed her eyes and said,
Sweet lady, accept his soul in peace.
Worm shit,
Lam swore and turned away. He started firing the laser at distant, higher parts of the tower above them.
Dorolo, Craiglin said, you, Wupslin and Yalson, head down there, see what...
Oh, shit.
Craiglin turned round.
Get down here, Mip. You drop them a line or the medkit, whatever. The rest of us were going forward to the bows, all right?
He looked around them, challenging.
You might want to go back, but that just means he's died for nothing.
Yalson turned away, switching off her transmit button again.
Might as well, Jandralajeli said.
I suppose.
Not me,
Nysin said.
I'm not. I'm staying here with the shuttle.
He sat with his head bowed between his shoulders and his helmet on the deck. He stared at the deck and shook his head.
Not me. No, sir. Not me. I've had it for today. I'm staying here.
Craiglin looked at Mip and nodded at Nysin.
Look after him.
He turned to Dorolo and Wubslin.
Get going. You never know. You might be able to do something. Yalson, you too.
Yalson wasn't looking at Craiglin, but she turned and followed Wubslin and the other woman when they set off to find a way down to the lower deck. A crash they felt through their souls made them all jump. They turned round to see Lam, a distant figure against the faraway clouds, firing up at flyer pad supports 5 or 6 decks above, the invisible beam licking flame around the stressed metal. Another pad gave way, flapping and spinning like a huge playing card, smashing into the level they stood on with another deck-quivering thump.
Lam! Craiglin burst out. Stop that!
The black suit with the raised rifle pretended not to hear, and Craiglin lifted his own heavy laser and flicked the trigger. A section of deck 5 meters in front of Lam ruptured in flame and glowing metal, heaving up then collapsing back down, a blister of gases blowing out from it, rocking Lam off his feet so that he staggered and almost fell. He steadied and stood, visibly shaking with rage even from that distance. Craiglin still had the gun pointing toward him. Lam straightened and shouldered his own gun, coming back almost at a saunter, as though nothing had happened. The others relaxed slightly. Craiglin got them all together. Then they set off, following Dorolo, Yalson and Wubslin to the inside of the tower and a broad sweeping spiral of carpeted staircase which led down into the megaship, the Olmedrekka.
Dead as a fossil,
Yalson's voice said bitterly in their helmet speakers when they were about halfway down.
Dead as a goddamned fossil.
When they passed them on their way to the bows, Yalson and Wubslin were waiting by the body for the winch line Mip was lowering from above. Dorolo was praying. They crossed over the deck level Lenny Pobra had died on, down into the mist,
and along a narrow gangway with nothing but empty space on either side.
Just 5 meters,
Craiglin said, using the light needle radar in his rare suit to plumb the depths of vapour below them. The mist was getting slowly thinner as they went on, up again onto another deck, now clear, then down again, by outside stairs and long ramps. The sun was hazily visible a few times, a red disk which sometimes brightened and sometimes dimmed. They crossed decks, skirted swimming pools, traversed promenades and landing pads, went past tables and chairs, through groves and under awnings, arcades and arches. They saw towers above them through the mist, and a couple of times looked down into huge pits carved out of the ship and lined with yet more decks and opened areas, from the bottom of which they thought they could hear the sea. The swirling mist lay in the bottom of such great bowls like a broth of dreams. They stopped at a line of small open-wheeled vehicles with seats and gaily striped awnings for roofs. Craiglin looked around, getting his bearings. Wobslin tried starting the vehicles, but none of the small cars were working.
There are two ways to go here, Craiglin said,
frowning as he looked forward. The sun was briefly bright above, turning the vapour over them, and to each side golden with its rays. The lines of some unknown sport or game lay drawn out on the deck under their feet. A tower forced out of the mist to one side, the curls and whorls of mist moving like huge arms,